As for me, as I looked upon her I could not but smile and sigh to think of the sweetness of a spiritual love that I could perceive was awakened in her heart, and, which made the admiration and the love of her twin soul a thing so dear to her that rather than brave the bitterness of indifference or dislike, or that tender toleration of mere gratitude, which to those who love, is as the gift of a stone where one is hungry and seeks for bread, she would leave the beloved object of all her cares and go forth to wander with me. I sighed because her words brought back to me all that I in my blindness had lost in losing my lanth, twin soul, and I smiled to see how fair she was and how unconscious of it. And I said, "Fare you well, Zuleika. Your path and mine diverge. For you, whose sins were those of frivolity and youth, and who hast striven so earnestly to overcome them, for you, and for Selim, there is a new life opening in the brighter spheres of the earth plain, where ye shall both gather that knowledge of life of, which death deprived you. For me, my path lies amidst those fields of wide and dangerous knowledge that I have elected to explore, and wherein you couldst not follow me. If you dost desire to leave here for a season, do so. But first let me advise you to go to Selim himself and see what he will say to your looks. Or stay, go yonder and look into that crystal stream that flows near our feet, gaze into its depths and methinks its waters will mirror back to you the answer you wilt get from Selim." Chapter 24, Long Years of Labor, I Meet My Mother, How the Spheres Are Interblended, Yet Discreet, The Gates and Portals. For many years I labored in the dark spheres and on the earth plane, helping and comforting those who were less fortunate than myself. At times I enjoyed a season of rest with my good friend Abubatha, and his patient faith and happy temperament did much to lighten the burden of my own cares, and to soothe my ever-present remorse for the loss of my sweet lanth, twin soul. Through all the weary waiting years, I never caught one glimpse of her again. No echo even of her thoughts could come to me. For the gates of the snow-white spheres had shut upon her, and to me they were ever impenetrable. Vain were all my longings, fruitless all my regrets. The wall that my own act had created, shut her away from me. Now and again at long intervals I had seen the vision of a silver star, and afar from it the golden star, but although they were a little nearer to each other as time passed on, I saw no signs of the rays from the one crossing the rays from the other, and thus I knew that our union was still afar off. As I wandered on the earth plain and worked in the dark spheres, I would sometimes meet those whose life threads had been intertwined with my own, and I knew that they also were working out their penance, and gleaning the harvest of the seeds which they had sown. Manzur I often saw, and from his wisdom I gained much valuable help, and as in time Jalal ad-Din joined us in our work, I came to meet them very often. For both these spirits, the path was far more rugged than for myself, and their work was so enormous that there was no possibility for them to ascend for many centuries from the dark spheres. But even for them, hope's star shone clear, and as their good deeds began to balance a little their evil ones, their surroundings became less somber. And yet the remorse those two suffered must have been terrible, for at every corner fresh consequences of their evil acts would rise up and confront them, and only the great courage and determination of the men could have enabled them to struggle on through the stupendous mass of evil, which they had built up around them. I cannot pause to describe any of the strange and varied scenes I saw during this part of my labors, for their records would fill volumes. But the experience I gathered from them was of priceless value to my soul. At last, after long, long years of labor, it came to pass that I wandered into a gray valley of shadows and lay down to rest, for soul and body alike were weary, and I longed for a season of repose. The valley was indeed a strange one, for everything looked like only the shadow of something else. The great trees that waved their branches gently overhead, the hills that rose on either side, the rocks that strewed the pathway through the glen, even the misty clouds above my head, were all like the shadowy reflections of another land, and in their very mistiness, there was a suggestion of the things one sees in sleep. I lay down upon the ground and almost immediately sank into a most sweet slumber. How long I lay asleep, I do not know, but when I awoke the scene around me had changed and I was in a new land, a glorious land of golden sunshine and fair flowers. My great pilgrim's robe too was gone, and youth had returned to my face and form, for the Valley of Shadows was the gate of death, and in my sleep I had passed into a new sphere. As I looked around me with delight, I saw my mother, the white angel of my childhood, coming towards me, and the next moment mother and Soon, so long parted, were clasping each other in a fond embrace. At first I could not speak, my heart was too full for words. Then I asked where I was. "You art in the third sphere, O my son. You hast passed into it from the second sphere below the earth where you did work. You might have enjoyed the pleasures of the beautiful second sphere above long since had you desired it, but I was not there to greet you, and we thought it best to leave you at your labors till you couldst come here to me." Again with much emotion I embraced her, and then I asked whether now I should be able to see my lost land, Twin Soul. My mother shook her head sadly. "Not even yet, O my poor son. Canst you see your beloved? The silver star opens not its gates ever to one who had known the passions of life. But your land, Twin Soul, shall be drawn down in time to you, and will meet you in the lands of the Golden Star, where as yet you hast not reached. Here you canst dwell with me, dear son, until the happy time comes, which will unite you with your land, Twin Soul. I have myself dwelt in the spheres of that silver star, and I can tell you of them. My love for you and for your father drew me around you both, and as I followed the lives of those I loved, I shared the thoughts and emotions of the souls so strongly linked with mine, and I gathered the experiences of life, developing my passions and living in my own hopes and fears for you, until I was no longer a fit dweller in the spheres of the star of calm unruffled peace. And where, O my mother, are the spheres of the silver star? Do they lie far from earth? Nay, my son. The spheres of the three stars of passion, of innocence, and of knowledge, that have for their symbols, the crimson, the silver, and the golden stars, stretch from the earth plane upwards through all the spheres of the planet Earth itself. They are divided from each other by the invisible walls of the attraction or repulsion, which the qualities of each exert upon the one opposed to it, so that they who belong unto the silver star can neither see nor come in contact with those who dwell in the rays of the crimson star, for they act upon each other with the strongest repelling force, while the qualities of the golden star are formed of a blending of the higher faculties of both, and thus the golden star hovers ever between them, and in its neutral spheres those who are drawn from the silver and the crimson stars can blend. In the second sphere, you canst see three gates. One is in the second sphere below. It looks, they tell me, like a gate of fire, whose flaming portals admit those whose passions bring them into affinity with the red star, into the realms of darkness, which men call hell. You hast passed that gate, my son, and you know into what lands it leads, and how from that gate you may descend into ever lower and lower depths of sin and passion. In the second sphere above the earth, there is the silver gate, wherein all the innocent and pure, all those who die in unsullied childhood or unsullied youth, do pass. Its lands are lovely to the eyes. Its realms are those of endless peace. Neither passion nor sorrow ever enter there. Therefore, as the memory of my husband and my child awoke, my sorrow at parting from them shut me out from the lands within the silver gates, and I dwelt outside for many years, till my own efforts to lighten the sorrows of others raised me to this sphere. And do all children pass into that land of the silver star? Not all, my son. There'll be some children born of parents so evil, so degraded, that they inherit evil propensities, and learn even as children to follow the dictates of childish passion. Such children remain near the earth, outside the silver gates, tended by spirit guardians. Still, many children enter the lands of the silver star, for most children are innocent of evil, in that they do not comprehend the nature of it. And now the third gate that I would tell you of is also in this second sphere above the earth. It is larger and more beautiful than that of the silver star, and is of purest gold. They who pass it are always men and women of full experience and ripe wisdom, and it opens only to those whose labors have taught them the control of their passions, and also given them the purity that comes of experience, not that which comes from irresponsible innocence. You hast not passed that gate as yet, but you shall do so soon, for it had its counterpart in every sphere, even as have each of the others, and it admits the soul to the special lands, which pertain unto the realms of the golden star in each sphere. And will Lanth, twin soul, join me then? I asked wistfully. Alas! No, Ahingziman, not even then can she come at once to you. She left the earth life so young and innocent, and the earth ties were so feeble, that only after long years yet to come, will she have gathered an experience, which will make her a fit mate for you. Had you but known, it would have been so easy for you to awaken her emotions while she was on earth and under your care, whereas now in that peaceful life of the Silver Star her love may be asleep for long, long years. Yet despair not, my son, in the memory of that 1 hour in which you did hold her in your arms, there is a link between you, and as you dost rise thyself, your thoughts, freed from earth, will rise more easily to her. My mother's speech saddened me, for my hopes had sprung into sudden life when I found myself in so fair a land. Still, I had learned now how short is time in comparison with eternity, and I felt that with my mother's love to soothe and comfort me I could still struggle to await in patience the coming of my vanished love. I felt this more especially as I considered how many waiting souls there were, whose lives, even amidst the fair surroundings of the higher spheres, were still like my own, incomplete. Ahingziman, said my mother tenderly, you hast wandered far, my son, your path had been long and weary, but the days of happiness are come for you at last. In this fair land you shall dwell with me and with your father, for he too shall shortly join us here. And as in the dark spheres you hast seen all the woes that evil produces, so here, you shall see what joys spring from the seeds of good. You hast seen the dark genii of the evil passions of man's soul, now you shall behold the good genii of unselfishness and purity and love, whose ethereal forms float in the air of these bright lands, and who have their dwelling places in the cloud palaces of golden hopes realized and happy dreams fulfilled. For as man's evil propensities assume form and shape in the spirit world of ethereal life, so do his good desires, and as the one is strong to haunt him with thoughts of evil, so are the others powerful to inspire him with aspirations for that which is pure and good. Thus the actions and thoughts of a man's life react, not alone upon himself and those with whom he comes in contact, but upon a countless multitude whom he had never seen, but who feel the influence of the good or evil genii which he had created. My mother now took me by the hand and led me to a beautiful archway of flowers, and together we passed into the fair gardens of that land of light. Chapter 25, Conclusion, The Gathering of My Friends, Marriage at Last of Twin Souls. More than 2,300 years have passed since I left the mortal body, and the history of the time in which I lived had become an ancient and half-forgotten story to the present generation of mankind. The city and palace of Barsaghad lay in ruins, with but a crumbling heap of grass-grown stones to mark where they bar once stood. The wandering Arabs pitch their tents where once kings held their court, and the jackal makes his lair amidst the broken fragments of the fatal secret passage. The temple of Amurat had also fallen into decay, and the faith of my forefathers had become an almost extinct belief, kept alive only by a scattered remnant of the ancient Persians, who worshipped the light of purity and truth under the emblem of the sacred fire. And as I stand upon a mountain top in that bright spirit sphere where I have dwelt with my beloved parents for so long, and look down to earth to view again the scenes of my earthly pilgrimage and mark the changes time had wrought, the visions of my past rise one by one before me, showing me again the drama of my life's story. But now there is neither sadness nor reproach in the pictures, they but show the weaving of the threads in the web of my destiny. As the last picture fades out in a haze of golden glory, I see all the friends whom I knew or loved in the days of my earth's history gathering round me, or sending to me from afar the reflex of their thoughts of me. I see first Mansur and Jalal ad-Din, still working on the earth plane and in the dark spheres, but working now as those who have conquered the evils of their past, and who are sowing the seeds of good that they may spring up and cover over the ruins they once helped to make, and veil them with flowers like a mantle of atonement. I see next my fair mother, clad in purest white, with a faint bordering of pink to mark where once the crimson stained her fair white robes. She wears a golden star upon her brow, and she looks up at my father with the half-shy happy look of a young bride, as she leans upon his arm. He wears no kingly robes now. No crown rests upon his head. His mantle is of green and gold, but fashioned like a student's, not a king's. For the burdens of state sat heavy on his soul, and he had been glad to cast them aside, to find in a life of study and the companionship of his sweet wife that happiness, which long years of labor in the dark spheres have won for him. With my parents, I see another figure, that of the faithful friend, the gallant soldier, the noble patriot, Ben Al-Zulid. And following them I see the dusky figure of that poor slave whom my father's orders had caused to be slain, to guard the secret of the passage, but whom in spirit life Al-Jazid had raised up and helped, till the wrong of the past had been forgiven, if not forgotten. Following these I see Bamba, the ever-faithful, and Zuleika and Salim. No longer doth Salim appear as the grotesque child with the face of an old man. He had grown up into the true understanding and power of a man's estate, while Zuleika is no longer the selfish frivolous girl, but a thoughtful gentlewoman, whose own sufferings have taught her sympathy with those of others. They make a very bright-looking handsome group, as they stand with smiling faces looking over to me. Artemisia stands beside her son, a queenly figure in robes of crimson and gold, with a long white veil falling from the golden crown she wears upon her head. For Artemisia is one of nature's queens, and her commanding nature makes of her a strong protectress to those of her own sex whose weaker natures make them glad to lean upon her calm strength. She had learned the secret of true sovereignty, as opposed to mere selfish state, and there is no spirit more noble, more constant in her unswerving devotion to others, than the once proud revengeful queen. As the vision of Artemisia and the others fades away, I see the radiant form of my beloved friend Abubatha. The shining brightness of his snowy robes no words can ever paint. The noble beauty of his face no language can express, as the dear friend and companion of my boyhood in spirit life draws near to me. Beside him I see the angel of the golden star, no longer clad in grey and gold but with robes of dazzling white and wings of glittering gold, while the golden star upon his forehead shimmers like the light from the Star of Truth. For the cycle of this angel's pilgrimage is at last complete, and he reigns now in the realms of the glorious golden star. He turns to me with a smile, as he says, "Look up, Ahimsemen, and see the crowning vision of joy that awaits you." As he speaks, I hear a strain of wondrous music, and I see a brilliant cloud of silver light appear, and as it floats down and down to me, I see that it is a vast throng of the angels of the silver star, accompanied by many youths and maidens in robes of white and silver, carry flowers, which they scatter around them as they float down to where I stand. In their midst I see a great mass of white blossoms, like a cloud of flowers, whereon there rests the lovely figure of my long-lost Lanth, twin soul, no longer a child, but a gentle maid, with the sweet child's face and the long floating hair I saw of old. She is dressed in white, and her robes are spangled with silver stars, while on her dark hair there is a crown of white flowers, and over her head there is thrown a veil of silver gauze. As she floats down, I see again the vision of the silver and the golden stars, but now they are near together. And as I look at them, I see that the rays from the golden star are touching the silver one and turning its whiteness into gold, and I know that the hour of my true romance had dawned for me at last. As my Lanth, twin soul, and her train of white spirits from the silver star reach the place where I stand, I know why it is that all the nearest and dearest friends of my past have gathered around me, and why even those whose spiritual conditions prevent them from entering my sphere have yet projected their thoughts to me in this the happiest moment of my existence, that as we have shared life's sorrows, we may also share its joys. And it is with a heart full of deep gratitude for all their friendship that I turn to greet my lovely bride. As I clasped her to my heart, I whispered to her, "Dost you remember still your patriarch?" She laughed and blushed, and raised her eyes shyly to my face. Then for answer she put her soft arms around my neck, and laid her fair head upon my breast, even as she had done on that faraway night when I had found and lost my love. and Voi. Many centuries separate me from my earthly life, yet I have not lost one iota of my interest in the lives of those who are toiling through their earthly pilgrimages. The faith of my forefathers has well nigh passed away, and the star of another faith had risen upon the earth and spread its teachings east and west, north and south. Yet is not truth the same under whatever religious garb we find it? Is not God, the same loving Father of all mankind, whether we call him by the name of the Jewish Jehovah or that given to him by any other nation of his children? Are they not all alike his children, or can we believe that while he loads with privileges one favored race, he will turn as a hard stepfather from the prayers offered to him by another, because their mode of worshipping him is different? And if all religions have their roots in the one fountain of all truth, may it not be possible that the restless discontent and skepticism of these later days of the 19th century of the Christian era, this searching amidst the teaching of the East, with its mystic doctrines and its secrets that may be revealed only to the elect few while the starving many have their eager hunger for light left still unsatisfied, this turning to occult studies in the hope that some new path may be found, may not all this be due to the efforts of the higher powers to make man recognize his universal brotherhood as an actual verity, not as a mere ethical form of speech, and to make each nation recognize the truth and beauty that are enshrined in the teachings of the others? As each acknowledges the virtues of the other, as each nation and class recognize the slenderness of the barrier that separates them, and the sacredness of the bonds that should unite, they are taking a step towards the millennium of perfect happiness of which every people of the universe have dreamed. And may it not also be that the spirits of the higher spheres in seeking to level the barriers between nations and classes and religions, are also striving to draw away those barriers that interpose between earth and the spirit world, and that, as in these days, the march of education, the diffusion of knowledge, the means of freer intercommunication between nation and nation, and the consequent spread of freedom of thought and liberty of action, have freed mankind from many of the dangers which surrounded the intercourse of the incarnate souls of earth with the disincarnate souls of the spirit world. Those doors of communication between the two worlds, which have been so long closed, are about to be thrown open again, that man's means of gaining knowledge upon earth may be augmented by the clearer knowledge of the spirit spheres. And since in the past those spiritual doors were closed by reason of the many errors that crept in, and the evil uses to which the unscrupulous turned the knowledge which they gained, may it not be that a part of the atoning work of those who abused or perverted their spiritual advantages in the past, consists now in returning to the earth and helping, with the clearer knowledge they have gained, and the purer, holier desires they have cultivated, to shed new upon the world the glorious knowledge of the higher spheres of spiritual life. The end. Notes. Note A. This story came to me under peculiar circumstances. It is printed as told by A. Rinzimann himself, but the names of the characters are purely fictitious and have no claim to historical accuracy. The accounts given by historians of the Persian history of that period are meager and often conflicting, although there is a general agreement as to the leading events, and as it may interest some readers to know who the actors in this true tale are, I give the real names. El-Jazid was Artaxerxes Longimanus of Persia, said by the Jewish historians to be the Ahasuerus mentioned in the story of Esther and Vashti. He is said to have been a singularly handsome, graceful man, tall and of commanding presence. Josephus, the Jewish historian, in giving the story of Esther and Vashti expresses the opinion that the action of the king in proposing to exhibit his beautiful wife to his boon companions after a banquet was intended as an insult to her and that she was justified in refusing to appear. In the opinion of Josephus, there were indications of a private quarrel and that the king took this public method of finding an excuse for deposing Vashti from her position of dignity and honor. If Artemisia was Vashti, then it is quite possible that the Damaspia who has gone down in history as the queen of Artaxerxes was some other wife than Vashti. Other historians ignore the story of Vashti and Esther. Artemisia was Vashti, the haughty, beautiful queen of Ash. Salim was Xerxes, the only legitimate son of Artaxerxes, who had reigned only 40 days when he was assassinated, it was said by Sogdianus. A. Rinzimann was Sogdianus. the illegitimate son of Artaxerxes. Various accounts are given of his character and the manner of his death, but all agree that he in his turn was assassinated by order of Acus, whom I call Armed, a third and illegitimate son of Artaxerxes. Acus then ascended the throne and reigned for a number of years. Ben-Azulid was Megabazus, the noted general of Artaxerxes. The other characters of the story are not mentioned in history. Note B. In all discussions as to the merits or demerits of transmediumship, one cannot but feel that there is amongst many people a total misconception of the true meaning of the word trance, that term being applied to any and every variety of hypnotic condition and to all forms of suspension of the individual consciousness. Strictly speaking, a trance should mean a condition of enchantment or delight, entrancing meaning to delight and uplift the spirit into a superior condition of sensation in which the soul, raised above the limitations of the lower or animal plane of existence, wanders in conscious pleasure amidst the highest thought regions to which that soul can gain access. In the words of John of Patmos, one may describe a true trance condition. John of Patmos visited a sphere with which he was mentally and magnetically in harmony, and what he saw was what such a soul would enjoy were it released entirely from the earth body, not merely lifted up from his earthly environments for a brief period. In the perfect trance condition, the soul retains a full and perfect consciousness of its own individuality, and is to all intents and purposes as much awake as when acting through the agency of its earthly body, while it possesses the added mental power which would be its attribute were it finally freed from the envelopment of that earthly envelope, which, while it protects the soul in earth life, also dulls and deadens its finer perceptions and limits its power of mental vision and its ability to receive the thought waves transmitted from other minds. The true master of magic is he who, having learnt all which can enable him to control mind encased in matter, can go one step higher and freeing himself from the limitations imposed by matter, roam at will into spheres too distant for the soul to reach while clogged by its grosser envelope. Furthermore, to take the soul out of the body into the free upper regions of pure spirit life is to give it the same spiritual refreshment, which climbing to the top of a high mountain or sailing upon the wide ocean gives to the tired and jaded mortal to whom change of air often means a renewal of life. Thought is a universal essence unbounded by any limitations of time or space, but it is also in its nature like light, and capable of having its rays refracted and its illuminating powers obscured by the mass of material thought atoms, which fill the atmosphere of planetary life even as the material dust particles affect the transmission of a ray of light. The constant giving off and absorbing again of every shade and variety of mental and physical atoms is a part of the unceasing pulsation of the life with which an inhabited planet teems, and we maintain that, while there be some minds so powerful in their mental grasp of the thoughts transmitted to them and so clear and strong in their power of mental vision, that they can overcome many of the limitations produced by their earthly environments, yet even these lofty and powerful intellects would be unable to wing their flight into still wider thought regions were they able to rise from their earthly body and, leaving it as the unconscious, unresponsive, because uninhabited, tabernacle of the soul, travel into those farther mental spheres with which the degree of their mental development put them in harmony. A perfect trance, then, should be the conscious flight of the soul into a superior condition from which it ought to return strengthened and refreshed and capable of wider thoughts and nobler and freer actions and a stronger and more perfect possession of its own individuality. The true seers of all ages who have left behind them knowledge, which is as valuable now as when first given to the world, were mystics who had mastered the true nature of the trance condition, and to apply the word trance to all those exhibitions of semi-conscious mental aberrations of persons whose sensitiveness lays them open to the mesmeric control of either incarnate or excarnate minds, is to propagate an error, which ought long ago to have been exploded. With the spread of mediumistic development, all and every variety and degree of subconscious conditions have come to be classed as trances, yet they bear no more resemblance to the true trance of the developed mystic of the older occult faiths than does the sleep, which is produced by the use of powerful narcotic drugs, resemble that of healthy tired nature. The hypnotically induced trance is as pernicious to the soul as would be the habitual use of narcotics to the body. Whether the hypnotizer, or, more correctly, the magnetizer, be in the flesh or out of it, the results are the same. An habitual use of magnetism to induce sleep or trance is an evil, and one which it would require a whole volume to properly illustrate. The wisest of spirit intelligences on both sides of life do not, then, use the magnetic forces to produce either trance or sleep, except as they would use a powerful medicine whose aid it was sometimes necessary to invoke, but whose habitual use was an evil even more deadly than that which it was designed to cure.